First up, however, is a gentleman that we've had on the program a number of times, discussing some of the disturbing questions surrounding the tragic events of 9/11. He is a professor of philosophy of religion and theology at the Claremont School of Theology in California, or has been for over 30 years, and co-director of the Center for Process Studies there, and the author or editor of over 20 books, including Debunking 9/11 Debunking, An Answer to Popular Mechanics, and other, defenders of the traditional theory of 9/11, the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, and The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11. It's now in its second edition. It's been revised and updated, and we are going to talk about that book tonight. David Ray Griffin, welcome back to News Talk 1010 CFRB.
Oh, thank you, Richard. Very good to be back with you.
Why the did you feel the need to revisit the New Pearl Harbor and update that? I mean, aside, I guess, from it going into another printing, perhaps. I know that there's a 30-page afterword, but is there new information there that you've added?
Oh, what I have just put out is not a revision of the New Pearl Harbor. It's a brand new book. It's a commentary on the New Pearl Harbor. And it's called The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, 9/11, The Cover-Up, and The Exposé. So, no, I did not want to revise The New Pearl Harbor again. I had done a revision, which I think you're referring to, with the 30-page afterword.
Ah, okay. Thank you.
Yeah, the first one actually came out, the first edition of The New Pearl Harbor came out, I think, at the very end of 2003, and then some other countries, Italy and China in particular, wanted to do a translation, so they asked me to update it, which I did in the middle of 2004, but just before the 9/11 Commission report came out. In the meantime, I've written several other books on 9/11, and but most people thought the New Pearl Harbor still had value retained as it was, but it was terribly out of date. So what I do, and also I made a few mistakes in it. So what I did in the New Pearl Harbor Revisited is correct those mistakes, but more importantly, bring the story up to date from everything that's happened since the middle of 2004 until the present.
The New Pearl Harbor Revised, 9/11
Revisited.
Revisited, I see. Okay. Now, let's talk a little bit about, when we come back, we're going to take a time out here. When we come back, let's revisit some of those areas that require updating, and also get you to explain, for those not familiar with the analogy to Pearl Harbor, why you've used that analogy, and we'll also just talk about generally the cover-up and why there needs to be a new investigation and some of the compelling evidence to suggest that the official theory simply doesn't hold water. David Ray Griffin with us here on the Richard Serrett Show. Stay with us. News Talk 1010 CFRB. David Ray Griffin is here. The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, The Definitive Treatment of 9/11. Really a much-needed companion piece to his movement-building book on 9/11, The New Pearl Harbor. And so really, I guess this could be looked as now as a two-volume set, David.
Well, that's right. That was the idea that I'd written these other books, the 9/11 Commission Report, Debunking 9/11 Debunking, 9/11 Contradictions. But if there were going to be a Senate investigation, let's say, or if some journalist was going to get serious in the mainstream about doing something, you couldn't expect him to wade through five books. So the idea was to get everything that was really essential in a two-volume set, and that's what we have here.
Well, you talk about the failure of the press to investigate any of the questions raised against the official account, and to me, this is when the mainstream news media fails to ask these questions, I mean, they are, in many respects, the guardians of our democracy. At least they play an important role in that. And they have really, I mean, on both sides of the border, around the world for the most part, totally let us down. If there was one or two lines of inquiry you'd like the press to pick up on right now today, what would they be?
Well, you and earlier you had asked how the new book differs. What points did I correct the earlier book? One of those was that in the earlier book, I assumed there really were hijackers on those planes. And so when I was discussing, say, Flight 93, I was talking about the messages that came from the passengers on their cell phone calls, talking about the hijackers having taken over the plane and so on. In the meantime, I've learned that when you look at all that evidence, and there are about 14 different kinds of evidence that the government has given us to convince us that there were Al-Qaeda hijackers on the plane, they all fall apart. And there's even one very strong argument against the presence of hijackers on the planes. Let me give an example. Probably the strongest evidence, if you ask anybody, well, how do you know there were hijackers on the plane? They say, well, all those phone calls from Barbara Olson and the other passengers reported that the planes had been taken over by Middle Eastern men. And in the meantime, that's all dissipated, thanks in significant part to the FBI, which, and here again, talk about the mainstream media not doing its job. One would think this should have been one of the screaming two-inch headline stories of the year in all of our major newspapers, because on 9/11, Ted Olson, who of course was the Solicitor General for the Department of Justice, and he was also the one who we can thank for getting Bush elected in the first place, because he's the one who argued before the Supreme Court that they should cancel the recount in Florida, which if it had gone forward, Gore would have won. So he's a very significant person. He told CNN and the FBI, I later learned, on 9/11, that his wife, Barbara Olson, the very well-known commentator on CNN, had called him from Flight 77, the plane that allegedly hit the Pentagon, and told him it had been taken over by hijackers. She called him twice, talked to him for about a minute each time. And this was one of the stories that got the American people really up in arms, really ready to go out and strike back at Muslims. Well, we didn't care too much, you know, we wanted to punish Muslims for killing Barbara Olson, for destroying the World Trade Center, for killing 3,000 people, and so on.
It was that phone call as well, I think, alleged phone call, that we first learned about the use of box cutters, etc., I believe.
It was the only, everybody knows the hijackers had box cutters, but that was the only phone call, alleged phone call, that mentioned box cutters. So that dramatizes how important it was. And yet, when the FBI turned in its report on phone calls from the planes at the Moussaoui trial, the so-called 20th hijacker, this was 2006, here's what it said about Barbara Olson. She attempted one call. It was unconnected. It lasted, therefore, 0 seconds. So if this should not have been a screaming headline, what should be? Because the FBI is part of the Department of Justice. And here the FBI report says that this most important report by the former Solicitor General of the Department of Justice wasn't true, which meant that either he lied or someone had lied to him, someone had duped him. Faking Barbara Olson's call.
And just so there's no misunderstanding, so again, those were allegedly from a cell phone, and I do not believe at that point American Airlines had the airphones on the back of the seats.
Well, this was another dimension of this story. Ted actually went back and forth. On one talk show, he would say, cell phone. On another one, he would say airphone. And finally settled on airphone, although most people still report it as a cell phone call. And you're right, there were two problems. One, Flight 77, we've learned since then, according to customer service, did not have airphones on its 757s, which is what Flight 77 was. And then the other problem was that, as the 9/11 Truth Movement had made, had publicized to those few people, you know, who would pay attention, that cell phone calls from high altitude airliners were not possible.
No, as A.K.
In 2001.
Exactly. A.K. Dewdney has performed some scientific experiments to that end. It's one loose thread, but it's an incredibly significant loose thread. And as you've pointed out, no one really in the mainstream news media has bothered to tug on it. And that is shameful and a complete dereliction of duty. Back with more of my conversation with David Ray Griffin, talking about the book, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited. The Richard Serrett Show, News Talk 1010, CFRB. Vlad Eisengrim from The Paranormal Show, live in studio at 11:30 with another paranormal experiment. And Nils Hamren from End Times Press counts down to Armageddon at 12:30. Right now, David Ray Griffin stays with us. And the new book is The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, which is a nice companion piece, sort of volume two. The volume one being The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions about the Bush Administration and 9/11. You were talking about the alleged Barbara Olson cell phone call from American Airlines Flight 77, which we know, according to the FBI, never took place. And that, coupled with the scientific studies, experiments of A.K. Dewdney, which shows that cell phone calls cannot be made while a plane is at a certain level, then what does that mean for the phone calls that were received from Mr. Beamer aboard Flight 93, David Ray Griffin?
Well, that's the next interesting question. And, you know, Dewdney and others had another Canadian, Michelle Chosudowski, had also argued that those cell phone calls were not possible. And the defenders of the official theory, such as particularly Popular Mechanics, said, oh, you know, that, no problem. That's just false. That we've checked with experts, and you can make them from 30,000, 40,000, maybe even 50,000 feet. And at the same time they were saying this, in 2006, the FBI was revising its story. And on Flight 93, which Dewdney had called the cell phone flight because there were more alleged cell phones from it, calls from it, than all the other flights put together, about 13 of them. The FBI, when it turned in that report to the Moussaoui trial, changed virtually all of those. It allowed that there were only two cell phone calls, and those were when Flight 93 had descended on its way to crash down to 5,000 feet. That's still a little high, but at least it's arguable that maybe calls would have been possible at that height from cell phones. But the important point is that all those other calls, all those people who were certain they have been called on cell phones, the FBI is saying, no, you weren't. You were called on passenger seat phones. Now, with most of those, they were simply told by the person calling them that he or she was using a cell phone. So we can say, oh, well, there was miscommunication there, or they misremembered or something. But in the case of Dina Burnett, she told the FBI that very day that she had gotten 3 to 5 calls, it normally is rounded off to 4, calls from her husband, Tom Burnett, and that she was certain he was using his cell phone because she looked on her caller ID and recognized his cell phone number. So what does a defender of the official theory do with that? Are you going to call Dina Burnett a liar, say that she lied? Why would she lie to the FBI about that? Are you going to say she was mistaken or she misremembered? 3 hours later, surely she wouldn't have misremembered such a dramatic event. Did she hallucinate? Surely not. So you're down to, I guess the only theory is that those calls were faked. And then people say, oh, that's not possible. Well, yes, it is. There
are devices, voice morphing,
that will fake the telephone number. You can just go on Google and see about that. And also, I had quoted a story from 1999 that showed already in 99 the voice morphing technology was good enough that people were fooled by what seemed to be the voice of Colin Powell saying my captors are treating me well. And another general who said something like, we've just started World War III. And so that seems to be the solution, and it seems to be the only possible solution. And once you admit some of those calls were faked, you about have to say, well, then they were all faked. And once you say all the cell phone calls were faked, and then you look at the alleged airphone calls or passenger seat phone calls and see they're essentially the same. They say the same kinds of things were being taken over by Middle Eastern hijackers and so on. All that you must conclude they were all faked.
All right, David, we'll take a time out. We'll come back. We'll talk about the World Trade Center towers, Building 7, and other matters here as we continue to discuss the new Pearl Harbor Revisited. David Ray Griffin, my guest, here on the Richard Serrett Show. Stay with us on News Talk 1010 CFRB. David Ray Griffin is with us. His latest is The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, The Definitive Treatment of 9/11. If you've got really what is Volume 1, The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration in 9/11, you'll want this one. It's a nice companion piece. Think of it as Volume 2. Now, why the comparison with Pearl Harbor? Why call it the new Pearl Harbor, David?
Well, the year before 9/11, this neocon group called the Project for the New American Century, which involved Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, among others, put out a document called Rebuilding America's Defenses. And in this document, they were talking about the decline of the Soviet Union, the fact that the United States was now the sole superpower, and that it should use this extraordinary power it has to create a Pax Americana, by which they meant the first all-inclusive global empire in history, and that this would take overwhelming military power. And that would include having dominance from space. They were talking about putting weapons in space. And, of course, that would be very expensive. And so they said this transformation of the military will probably happen slowly, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. And sure enough, when 9/11 happened, it was immediately called the new Pearl Harbor.
In other words, that was the pretext that they needed, not only for a rapid buildup in arms, but also, you know, the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan and on it goes.
That's right. And also for the passing the Patriot Act, which greatly reduced civil rights, and also for getting the Bush Doctrine, this thing that Sarah Palin didn't know what was, is the doctrine that contrary to traditional international law since the founding of the United Nations, we didn't have to wait until we had definite knowledge that another country was ready to attack us before we could attack it. We could say, we need to attack them before they get strong enough to attack us. So even if the threat isn't imminent, we can go ahead and attack. And that was the doctrine that was used then to attack Iraq. And another interesting thing about that is the person who wrote that document, which is called A National Security Strategy of the United States of America 2002, Condoleezza Rice, was responsible for getting that document written. She brought in her old friend Philip Zelikow, whom she had worked with in the first Bush administration. They had written a book together. He had helped with the transition to the new Bush administration. He wrote that document. And then, of course, he was the one who later became executive director, who's the one who really ran the 9/11 commission.
All right, let's work in a phone call here, and we'll say hello to Albert in Toronto. Welcome to News Talk 1010. You're on the line with David Ray Griffin. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. My name is Albert, and I was wondering what the propaganda value of Bin Laden would be. Like, how do you see it being played out? Will Obama go on TV to read his lines to say they found Bin Laden hiding in Pakistan, the lie for public consumption, so that they can rampage the troops through Pakistan? Because after all, he's a shill for the big new Brzezinski, and he writes that's exactly what they covet, is to invade Pakistan in the book by Brzezinski.
All right, David Ray Griffin, the idea that this bogeyman Bin Laden remains out there, any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, we had an announcement this morning that there was a new threat from Bin Laden, and the one problem with this is there seems to be very good evidence that he's no longer with us, and in fact died in 2001. And so I'm actually working on a new article today called If Bin Laden Is Dead, How Can He Keep Issuing These Threats?
All right, thanks for the call, Albert. A quick timeout, come back more with David Ray Griffin. The new Pearl Harbor Revisited. The new Pearl Harbor Revisited. Back with more of The Richard Serrett Show. News Talk 1010, CFRB. David Ray Griffin is with us. The new Pearl Harbor Revisited. And, David, we'll save the World Trade Center buildings in 47, Building 47, till after the news when we have more time. So let me just quickly jump over to the Pentagon. And talk to me about the accounts of bombs inside the Pentagon on that day.
Well, there were many people who reported that they believed that bombs had gone off. Some even evidently said they smelled cordite. One of these people was April Gallup. She had just she was in the army. She was just away on maternity leave. She just had a baby, and she came back after 2 months and brought him to work with her. And she went in and said she sat down and turned on a computer. And as soon as she hit the button, there was this enormous explosion, knocked stuff from the wall. The ceiling came down, hit her on the head. She was knocked out for a little bit. And then got up and found her son and pulled him out of the rubble, walked out of the Pentagon through the very hole that allegedly was the hole that was created by the airplane, and said she didn't see any sign of an airplane. They took her to the hospital, and she didn't even have an idea that the Pentagon had been hit by a plane. And when the guys from the Pentagon came down to debrief her, she said, well, I think, you know, it was a bomb. And they said, no, no, ma'am, it was a it was an airplane. And she says, well, I don't think so. I think if there had been a plane there, I would have seen something, but I saw absolutely nothing. And then you'll see in the book that I've quoted many other people, and some of these from books that otherwise support the official story, you know, not books by members of the 9/11 Truth Movement. And yet you've got these quotations of various people who show up at the site and say, well, I heard there was a plane here. Where's the plane? And there's no sign of a plane.
All right. Now, we've just got about a minute here till the top of the hour and news at that time. Talk to me then.
By the way, Richard, stay on the line after you after we sign off here.
Oh, yes. I'd like to take you on till 11:30 if we can. Is that possible?
Let me talk to you privately when we're off the air. Huh?
All right, we'll do that.
Okay.
All right. News coming up here at the top of the hour, and hopefully we can continue along with David Ray Griffin talking the new Pearl Harbor Revisited. Back with the Richard Serrett Show, News Talk 1010, CFRB. Welcome back. We'll just steal a few more moments of David Ray Griffin's time. His new book is The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, The Definitive Treatment of 9/11. And because we're a little tight on time, David, let me ask you this. One of the questions that I get time and time again on this show whenever we discuss 9/11 is that, or not a question, but just disbelief from people. They can't imagine the people inside the U.S. government, whether it's a shadow government or anyone, targeting its own citizens. And I point out that there is some precedent for this, and of course you talk about that as well in your book. Talk to us about Operation Northwoods.
Well, that was a rather notorious event, that had it not been for President Kennedy turning it down, we would have invaded Cuba in 1961 or 62. What happened was Kennedy had taken Cuba away from the CIA after the disaster at Bay of Pigs and given it to the Pentagon. Well, the Joint Chiefs of Staff came up with a set of plans, or scenarios. The whole thing was called Operation Northwoods, which they labeled a set of pretexts for invading Cuba. And some of them included killing American citizens. In one case, they said, well, you know, we can have a Remember the Maine incident. And, of course, it was the sinking of the Maine, and that's still questioned, you know, how that came about. But the United States government, this was in 1898, used the sinking of the Maine as a pretext to invade Cuba, to steal it, take it away from the Spanish. Of course, the Spanish were fighting a war with the Cubans. The Cubans had a war of liberation.
To which William Randolph Hearst once said, when a reporter, he sent a reporter down there before the war had started, and he said, you get me pictures of the war, and the reporter said, wait a minute, there is no war. He said, you give me the pictures, I'll provide the war.
That's right. And we blame Spain for sinking the Maine. Well, that's the last thing they would have done. They did not want America in that war. In any case, there in 1961, these Joint Chiefs of Staff came up with what they said, we will have a Remember the Maine incident in which we will sink an American ship, naval ship, and blame the Cubans. And they had other scenarios in which Americans would be attacked on the streets of Miami and elsewhere by Cuban, you know, sympathizers with Castro, and use that as a pretext. And there was even a scenario in which they would put passengers on a plane and make it college students going on vacation. And then they were going to switch the planes, but make it look like the Cubans had shot down this plane while it was traveling near Cuba. And they had various scenarios in which they would either pretend to kill Americans or actually kill Americans and use that as a pretext. So anybody who says, well, our Pentagon simply wouldn't do such a thing, can see that, well, yes, they would have. And Kennedy turned it down, but if Nixon had been president, it's pretty certain he would have accepted the plan.
Talk to me a little bit about the extent to which, in your mind, the actual 9/11 Commission report in itself was a cover-up operation.
Well, the extent, let's say, about approximately 100%.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, people have said, well, did you find any lies in there? And I've said, well, you know, the hard thing is to find anything that is not a lie. When you consider that, you know, each sentence is part of a paragraph, part of a chapter, and the overall point of the chapter is to tell a lie. The 9/11 Commission, as I said, was run by Philip Zelikow, not by Cain and Hamilton. They hardly ever came by, and all the investigation, such as it was done by the staff, and that was under Zelikow's charge. And you know, the 9/11 Truth Commission movement had made some pretty strong charges against Zelikow, and we found that what we were saying wasn't half the truth. Philip Sheehan of the New York Times recently wrote this book called The Commission, and showed that Zelikow was even worse than we thought he was in terms of the lies and the deceit. That, for example, he promised to break off all contact with senior White House officials and yet remained in contact with both Condoleezza Rice and Karl Rove. So this was anything but an independent report. It was a report essentially written by the White House's own man. And he not only assigned the topics and decided what research should be done and what shouldn't be done, he also took charge of writing the final document. So it's really his report.
The omissions in the report, one of the most glaring to me, well, there are many, but one is the refusal to include the testimony of the Secretary of Transportation, Norman Mineta. I mean, this is a member of the cabinet who has some pretty compelling evidence indicating that a stand-down order had been given by Vice President Dick Cheney. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, Mineta said he got to the White House about 9:15 that morning and went in and saw Richard Clark. Clark told him, go downstairs to the underground bunker and join the Vice President. Many other people have said that's Mineta went down there then, and that Cheney had gone down earlier than that. Cheney went down about 9:10, evidently, got there before 9:15. And Mineta said, when I got down there at 9:20, Cheney was already there and involved in an ongoing conversation with a young man who would come in the room and say, Mr. Vice President, that plane is now 50 miles out, came back in. Now it's 30 miles out, comes back in and says, Mr. Vice President, the plane is now 10 miles out. Do the orders still stand? And Cheney whipped his head around and said, of course, have you heard anything different? And that was shortly before the Pentagon was struck. And so it did sound like a stand-down order, although that's not the way Mineta himself interpreted it. So he didn't mean to be making any inflammatory charge. He just reported what he heard and said he assumed it was an order to shoot the plane down. But, of course, nothing was shot down. And you wouldn't, you know, the young man wouldn't have been puzzled if it had been an order to shoot the plane down. If it's a commercial plane, anything but a military plane, on that day after two buildings had already been struck, that would be the natural thing to do, anything coming near that forbidden zone.
Sure, and if they're going to be shot down, they would have been done much sooner. Why would he come in and say 40 miles, 30 miles, 10 miles, and still no shoot down?
Yeah. So in any case, then the 9/11 Commission simply deleted that and made no mention of it in their report, even though obviously it was vital information. In their own video record of their commission hearings, this was set in open hearing, they deleted, this is the one part of the video record that is missing, about 3.5 minutes here. But if anybody doubts it, they can go on Google or YouTube, I don't know where it is now, but just type in Mineta Cheney and you'll get a video of this conversation. The 9/11 Commission said that Cheney didn't even get down to that underground bunker until almost 10 o'clock. So they implied that conversation could not have occurred.
Ah, well, that's...
it's a pretty big lie. You're talking about a 45-minute lie.
Yes, very interesting. Final question, David, before we let you go, and that is any glimmer of hope now that with an administration change that we might get closer to some sort of a new investigation with a Barack Obama in the White House?
Yeah, I get this question all the time, of course, and all I can answer is that if it had been McCain, there would have been no chance. With Obama, there is at least a chance, and certainly the 9/11 Truth Movement will be working full speed to try to exploit that chance and make it come about.
All right. David Ray Griffin, always a pleasure. Thank you. And once again, the new Pearl Harbor Revisited, the definitive treatment of 9/11, and I'm guessing Amazon.com?
That's right. Certainly you can get it there at a reduced rate or at good bookstores everywhere, including there in Toronto.
Wonderful. A pleasure, David. Thank you for this.
Okay. Thank you, Richard.
All right.